Strangers and Aliens, Episode 60, The Heath McNeice Interview.
Welcome to the Strangers and Aliens Podcast.
Strangers. To boldly say what needs to be said.
Would you be a stranger or an alien? Or would you be a strange alien?
The truth is out there. I am your father's best friend, Plumber. Superman.
Wonder Woman.
Heroes. Villains. Captain Picard versus Captain Kirk.
Do you think that there's room in sci-fi for God? The very first thing that God did...
So wise you are.
...was that he created something, so we have a creative God.
This is Strangers and Aliens Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Strangers and Aliens. My name is Steve MacDonald, and usually I have Dr. Jace with me, but today I have just Ben Avery.
Howdy.
Sorry, I didn't let you talk over you. We have a very special guest tonight, a Christian performer. He has albums that show up and shows that cover rap, acoustic stuff, spoken word, worship music, whatever else happens. His name is Heath McNeice. His first album dropped in 2007, but he's been much more prolific since 2010, I guess, with like 6 or 7 albums and a whole bunch of different styles. Welcome to Strangers and Aliens, Heath.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Very cool. Just to give you a little bit of a background, Ben is a writer and an editor, among many other things, and I am 46, overweight, and lifeless.
Oh, man, wow.
That's a really sad introduction.
My worst nightmare come to fruition.
No, I'm just dropping a line from one of his songs that sort of touched me last year. But yeah, well, let's jump right into this. A lot of our listeners, they're much more into the, you know, sci-fi, fantasy type of the pop culture, how that touches faith. We're talking more about like Christian rap, Christian hip hop, and that's gonna probably be a little bit foreign with some of our audience. Could you, I don't know, give us maybe like a quick history, Christian rap, and like your place in it?
Sure. First of all, please forgive me. I have a terrible cold. I'm performing in the Midwest, and it's freezing cold out here. So, please forgive that. As far as being Christian rap or whatever. I'm probably the worst person to ask. I mean, I do know of its origins. I mean, it's important to me to sort of, you know the history of the things that I'm involved in. But, you know, for me, I'm more of just a hip-hop enthusiast in general. For me, the decision to make positive music that was infused with faith was more of a personal decision based on the fact that I love hip hop and not based on the fact that I wanted to be a Christian rapper. I think that that is a pretty, it's a much argued term. There are dudes that, you know, think that you must be ministering through your music and people
right.
that, you know, you need to say that I'm a rapper who's a Christian, not a Christian. Honestly, it doesn't matter to me what people call it as long as they call it good. I don't think that I just, you know, I'm just always contented, most deaf is a Muslim. Nobody calls him a Muslim rapper.
Right.
You know, the Beastie Boys had, you know, roots in Hinduism. Nobody really called them Hindu rappers or
right.
anything like that. It just, there's an air of, you know, exclusivity that is sort of attached to that,
mm-hmm.
that I'm just not really a big fan of. Because it makes it sound like only people of your similar, you know, faith would be able to benefit from it. And I've just never really contended that's the mode of operation that I would adhere to. So, I listened to, you know, a few rappers that were Christians that, you know, kept it clean and kept it really creative. And those were the dudes that I sort of gravitated towards. And, a lot of the places that I play happen to be churches, but then a lot of the places that I play happen to be, you know, bars and clubs and colleges and festivals and coffee shops. And
right.
So, you know, it's you know, I think much like just living your life in the real world, your faith just happens to intersect with other people's lives. And if you're a believer, then your faith is bound to come out in everything you do. And for me, that includes music.
Very cool. Yeah, very cool. We come into people, and you know, like someone says, oh, we're going to make a Christian movie or, you know, a Christian novel or something. And we, on this program, we deal with that all the time with people who, you know, are you going to lock yourself inside that box? Or, you know, is, and some people, it opens them more up. You know, they see it as sort of a, this is the sandbox I want to play in. And that's the sandbox I'm going to be in. So, you know, it's different for different people. So thanks for clearing that up. What styles of music, just in case people are more interested in a little bit, you know, to try to, you know, not pigeonhole you, but, you know, you do a whole lot of stuff. What styles of music would you consider your stuff to be?
You know, I do a lot of hip hop stuff. I do a lot of, you know, it's very lyrical and it's nature, whether it's fun stuff or serious stuff. It's always very, very lyrical, but right. Some of it is very satirical. Some of it can be very religious. Some of it can be very political. Some of it can be very pop culture centered. You know, I try to root a lot of what I do in humor when it pertains to hip hop, because, you know, I don't want to take myself too seriously in that role. And I play a lot of live shows. A lot of what I do is, you know, predicated upon being able to recreate it in a live show setting. So, you know, a lot of it is just, you know, it's a good time. Lyrically. Real tall when they missing amenities. Down to the floor like a friggin' anemone. Geppetto with a screen work, living divinity. Dots, FX, boom, stickety. Cut that string in a minity. Ever act grown up, enemy. $1 bills, now give me the Kennedy. I do a lot of indie folk stuff, you know. I think a lot, you know, some of it is more acoustic in nature. Some of it is more just, you know, full bandish in nature.
Former for your sake, if it's bread, wine, I'll choose what's further from my mind.
Really, really heavily influenced by, you know, blues and classic rock. A lot of, you know, I mean, the Beatles are my favorite band, as, you know, they are for many people. But I think the thing that I really enjoyed the most about the Beatles were, you know, like Paul McCartney's more kind of folksy, Americana-sounding songs. And, you know, then that sort of turned me on to other things, you know, your Bob Dylan's, your Simon and Garfunkel's, your...
Right.
Even, you know, even stuff like the Carpenters, you know, the, like that was sort of what my parents, you know, raised me on, you know, Peter, Paul, and Mary and stuff like that.
Yeah, you just described my iTunes library there.
Yeah, Ben's a huge Carpenters fan.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot of folksy stuff that I was raised on. And, you know, I think that's sort of... descriptive of everyone now. Like, I think listening to everything was maybe a big deal a long time ago, but I think it's, you know, everybody's iPod looks, you know, very manic. You know, you're picking music to fit a mood, you're picking it to fit a road trip or a party or, you know, your senior class, you know, you're, yeah. Like, music is just a catalog now. Like, I don't really think about, you know, just songs. You know, I remember, like, I skinned my knee when I was listening to this, you know. I was, you know, I was on my way to, you know, my high school graduation when I listened to this.
Right.
You know, my brother, you know, punched me in the face right after I listened to this song, or whatever. Like those are the things that, you know, I sort of just bookmark it, you know, and then it's just sort of a grab bag, you know. I was listening to, you know, Fear of a Black Planet when I was way too young to be listening to Fear of the Black Planet by Public Enemy. And, you know, that's fine. But I think everybody kind of works like that now. You know, I don't know a lot of people who are just like, nah, man, I just listen to metal, or I just listen to country. You know, everybody sort of has a little bit of everything. And, you know, that happens to come out of my music. Like, I don't try to purposefully to make different music. It's just, you know, it's just in me to make different music, and that's sort of how it comes out.
Very cool.
Well, where did it start for you? Like, you know, I'm listening to the Weight of Glory album, and all of a sudden you started rapping, and I was kind of like, well, that's weird, because it's more of a folksy rock kind of thing.
Liar, lord, a lunatic, higher form of humor with a fire for the foolish, tripping kind of toward a fuselage. Silence sort of dude that caught a violent mortal wound with defiance for the future, said that I'm immortal too. Judas on that road, swing back like a catapult. 30 silver pieces on the ground, y'all add it up. John, beloved, look up and father, brother, look down and fallen mother, like all the sinners covered, like Pontius Pilate washing hand until his skin pills. Sin kills Hindenburg and Windows like a pinwheel. Cup passing from his lips, it wasn't his will. Lion, lord, a lunatic, you took me out.
And then I started listening to your other stuff, and I'm like, oh, now it makes sense why that happened. But where did it start for you?
Just music in general?
Like, as far as you as a musician.
You know, my mom was a choir director in church. And so from 4 to 5, you know, we were just, you know, you know, my dad was a head deacon, so we're in church, you know, 5-6 days a week sometimes. And so you're just around it. You're just around it all the time. And, you know, learning every hymn in the hymn book, and not just learning the hymns, but like knowing what page it was. Like, I knew the song leader said, turn to page 275 in your hymn book. I knew that was Just As I Am. If he said 305, it was He Set Me Free. If it was 165, it was the Old Credit Cross. Like,
awesome.
you sort of just start knowing these things, and, you know, then they just become a part of you. Even as a little kid, it didn't matter to me. Music didn't matter. It was just a part of who I was. And I never, you know, took lessons or wanted to sing or wanted to do anything like that, because growing up in the South, you know, boys didn't do that. You know, like, growing up where I grow up, you don't do that. You'll get beat up. So, you know, I never really did those things.
And you're from the Atlanta area, right?
I grew up in South Georgia, like right above Tallahassee, Florida, in a little town called Colquitt, Georgia. So it's in the swamps, you know, it's an awesome place, but, you know, it's a little removed and isolated from, you know, the acceptance of, you know, things that are, you know, counterculture or anything like that. So, and it's content to be that way. That's fine. You know, it was a weird time for me. And, you know, as I got older, when I got into high school, I became far more curious about, you know, music and how it fit into my life, because I was listening to so much of it. And, you know, listening to hymns, obviously, as a little kid. But also I had, you know, my oldest brother listen to gangster rap and, you know, would sort of hide it from my parents and stuff like that. And, you know, I wanted to be like my oldest brother, you know. Whatever he was listening to, I was listening to. But I was just way too young to be listening to it, you know. Like, it was, you know, it was violent, it was real, and it was awesome. But I was too young to be able to filter that properly. So, you know, I was listening to gangster rap, you know. And then that sort of captured my imagination a little bit. Just not the exploits of gangster rap, just the idea of, like, these dudes who had nothing to their name and just sort of started making music out of nothing, you know. Like, they reassemble, you know, old, you know, pieces of soul and funk and blues music and sort of make it their own. I just thought there was something kind of beautiful to that.
Yeah, Public Enemy's Sound, yeah. The Bomb Squad, they, I mean, that was a major influence on when I put stuff together, just to see how they take stuff and they just transform it into something brand new. And it can be stuff from, you know, old gospel albums. It can be stuff from, you know, the thing that was just released last, you know, a couple months ago or something. They just...
Yeah, and I think hip hop gets a really weird, unfair, sort of judgment from a lot of people in culture, and, you know, as far as like what sampling is, and mm-hmm. you know, like it's not like taking someone's idea, someone's hard work, and making it your own. What it is like it's piecemealing together sections of ideas to reinterpret and to sort of interpolate something. I mean, there are people who've blatantly ripped off people's music, but the way I see that is, so does every rock band that yeah. ever listened to Robert Gibson, you know, or B.B. King. Like, yeah. it's harder to say, oh, this is exactly what they did, because it's, you know, it's not an actual recording that's being reformatted. They're just saying, oh, well, this is what he did, I'm going to do that. That's what everyone does. Like, there's nothing new under the sun. There's nobody that's 100% original, and that's why it makes things cool, and that we're, you know, you take things and you rebrand them. It's not like any of the stuff that I do on the C.S. Lewis record is original. They're chords. They're chords and they're notes that everyone else has played at.
But you made those chords up. Those are just yours, right?
Yeah, I have an exclusive copyright on the G chord. Like, it's fine. I own it. And because I both create music solely, you know, from an original standpoint and sample, you know, I feel like I come from both sides of the fence, and I just feel like hip-hop sort of got a really bad rap, no pun intended, as far as that goes. And that's just, I was drawn to it as a little kid, and that, you know, sort of sent me down the path of becoming more interested in the lyrical side of it, and, you know, I was a performer. I loved theater. That's what I got my degree in, was in drama, like performing theater. So I was a practitioner of the stage, and before that, I was just a kid who was in plays, and I did things like that. And I thought, well, if I can just learn to rap a little bit, I think I can make a really good live show out of it, because I'm a good performer. And then, so it sort of started off as a little bit of a joke, and then it became a very serious pursuit. So.
Very cool. Now, the Way to Glory album is, it's not your latest album. You have two that has come out since then, right? But this was back in the...
Yes.
Late summer last year, and
it was like 6 months ago. But it, you know, when you put out stuff as quickly as I do, sometimes it makes it sound like it was forever ago. But it was just a few months ago.
Now that that's inspired by C.S. Lewis, and what led you to that project?
Well, one of my older brothers studied at Oxford University in England, and he had a lot of contact with scholars who knew Tolkien and knew C.S. Lewis.
Wow.
He was able to actually look at, you know, manuscripts of things that they'd written, actually sort of see some of the printed words that they had.
Wow.
It was a huge experience for him, and his excitement about that, you know, when I was, you know, in high school, got me really excited about, you know, sort of reading things beyond just, you know, the Narnia series. And, you know, when I read the Screwtape Letters, it was a huge, huge step forward for me spiritually. And I think just as a reader. And that's still my favorite C.S. Lewis book.
Nice.
But, you know, as I just started reading more of his like essayist sort of treatise work, like that's when I, you know, really became involved in who, you know, who he was, what he was trying to convey. And I just remember I had an audio CD, I think that my brother gave me, of C.S. Lewis reading The Four Loves.
Mm-hmm. Nice, yeah, I got that.
And as I was driving and I was listening to that, I just thought, man, you know, it would kind of be cool to, you know, sort of focus on that song. You know, like The Four Loves was the song that I thought, man, maybe I could make a song out of this. And I wrote it very quickly. It, you know, it happened. I was at some hotel in Michigan, and I just wrote it really, really quickly.
I was born inside a home. The youngest of the three boys who fought with daddy's stubborn heart. Mama cleaned. Strangers' floors. And God knows that he made it hard. She broke her back to keep her babies warm. And this is the love that made me grow.
I think because it was so easy and I was just so full of excitement to do that song, and it came out so well, I just thought to myself, well, maybe I could do a whole, maybe EP out of this. Maybe I can make 6 or 7 songs out of this. And it just sort of, you know, progressively every song that I tried to tackle, with the exception of a couple, just came really, really easily. So I just decided, you know, why don't I just try to make a whole album out of this? And I think I wrote the first one in March, and I was in the middle of writing other stuff too, so I wasn't wholly committed to writing stuff maybe until April or May, and I think I got really serious about it in May, and you know, spent maybe a good 6 weeks writing, you know, as I could, you know, because I tour a lot, I don't have a ton of time to spend on those things, so I had to whittle away some time, and it came really quickly. There were only a few songs that were tricky to actually convey the way that I wanted to.
Which ones were tricky?
Screwtape Letters was actually really tough for me because I just loved the book so much. I was kind of psyching myself out. I was like, you can't ruin this song. This book means so much to you. You can't ruin it. Then The Problem of Pain was tough for me because I'd already written The Grief Observed, and The Grief Observed was, I thought it was lyrically the strongest thing that I'd written on the record, and I just didn't want the parallels, because Grief Observed and Problem of Pain do have some sort of overlap,
yeah.
And I didn't want them to seem too similar, and I think I was just thinking too seriously with The Problem of Pain, so I just brightened up the melody, and once I sort of made it a little bit more of a bouncy kind of melody and rhythm, I think lyrically I was able to say some things that were still very stark, but they stood out in contrast heavily to Grief Observed. And then The Weight of Glory was tough because, you know, I knew I was going to call the album The Weight of Glory, and there are a lot of ideas to fit inside a 3.5-minute song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is the view from outside the world. A face is pressed fast to the wrong side of the door. Where sin did abound, grace did much more. Replace with the substance of things I hope for. The weight of this glory is bringing me down to my knees. The hope that's found in this burden is bringing me down to my knees.
And the thing that I didn't want to do was I didn't want to summarize his work. Like, that was what I wanted to really avoid. I didn't want to summarize what his books were about. What I really wanted to do was just share what inspired me the most about his books. And, you know, if that meant, you know, little pieces of his writing or just what the pieces of his writing meant to me, like, that was important to me. I didn't want to, you know, try to re-explain what he already said better than anyone else ever could. Right. I just wanted to sort of musically, you know, whittle down some of the inspiration that it gave me and make it palatable in a different way, you know, for people who just can't stop consuming his work, mm-hmm. but eventually you run out of stuff to read. and so, you know, you maybe just look for new ways for his ideas to come alive, and that's why people make movies. That's why Shadowlands was written. You know, like, we just were fascinated by him and what he did, and I just think that the album has resonated with just thousands and thousands of people because of how curious they are about him and to just get more out of his work. And, you know, I'm very thankful that, you know, that album has been able to do that. And I didn't think about it at the time, but once it was ready to come out, I was like, you know what? There are a lot of people that are really going to be going over this with a fine-tooth comb because they're huge Lewis, you know, and people that know more about him and his works than I ever could. And they're really going to be like, this is not right. This is terrible. Why did you guys do this? And it didn't really occur to me that that might happen until it was time to put the record out. But fortunately, that hasn't happened.
Well, I don't think that can happen, though. I mean, I guess people could do that, but you're taking such a personal approach in a lot of these songs.
Yeah.
It's your personal response in some ways to what C.S. Lewis wrote. I mean, no one can fault you for, they can fault you for, you know, messing up a historical detail or something like that, right, but that's not what this is, you know, or a theological detail, but that, again, that's not what this is. This is you responding to it.
It would be like if Ben was writing the X-Men comic book and someone picked it up and was like, Stan Lee did the X-Men back in the 60s. This is junk. It's like, yeah, well, I'm taking the same characters, same ideas, same types. No, come on, you can't do that. It has to be all new. It has to be all original. It's like, well...
well, that's not going to happen either, Steve. But
exactly. Which is exactly the reason why I said I don't want to summarize these works.
Uh-huh.
You know, I want them to be, you know, personal. And you know, I've gotten lots of offers to come speak at universities and answer questions about the record, and, you know, I was talking to my brother, who would be far more qualified to do that, as he's a bit of a scholar when it comes to that. But I was telling him, yeah, this is intimidating. I don't know everything about C.S. Lewis. I don't know anything about his life. I don't know everything about, you know, every theological, you know, decision and you know, postulate that he made. Like, I know what influenced me, and he said, that's exactly why I didn't want to talk to you.
Right.
Because these are people that know everything about him,
mm-hmm.
but what they want to know is, how did you get to the root of some of the things that he said emotionally? Like, that's what they want to know. Like, because I've had so many amazing emails and messages and people that, you know, see me at shows that say, like, a grief observed hit me as a song, hit me in a way that I can't thank you enough for that song because of this that I'm going through, or that my mom has gone through, or that our family went through.
Yeah.
You know, ways to sort of get to, you know, a 3.5 minute investment is different than reading a book.
She says she was at peace with God. Oh, she knew that I was not. The chaplain gave his final thoughts. She exhaled and then smiled, but it was not for me. A grief observed. How wicked would it be for you to wish her back now that she's through? To pray here once she's passed through. A ray of light between right now and evermore. Grief observed.
You don't always have the time or the wherewithal, you know, to just sit and read. It requires different things than listening. But with the addition of music and the lyric put in a specific way, poetically, not that C.S. Lewis isn't incredibly poetic, but when it's, you know, I think administered in that way, it allows people to, even if their defenses are up, it allows the songs to have an impact. And, I'm incredibly blessed, you know, that so many people have been so blessed by the record. And I continue to really want to reach out with the record and you know, continue to share it with people because it's been such a worthwhile endeavor. And at the end of the day, I had very little to do with it. Like, I could have never written those songs on my own. Those songs were, you know, inspired by, you know, a writer who is, you know, one of my, you know, ultimate inspirations, and they're about themes that are far bigger than I could ever wrap my head around. And so I was just blessed enough to have, you know, the inspiration to, you know, try and emotionally interpret what it meant to me. And luckily, because these themes are universal, they've connected with, you know, thousands of people who, you know, are in the same boat as I am. You know, we're not smart enough to think like him. We didn't get the antenna straight to the throne room like he did. We just appreciate the work, and it draws us closer to God and closer to our families, and understanding, you know, a little bit better what, you know, this what this situation is all about, and makes us ask more questions. And that's amazing. That's a great thing.
Yeah, definitely.
I wanted to ask you about Screwtape Letters specifically, because I, when I was listening to the albums, I was just thinking, well, how is he going to approach that one? You know?
Yeah, me too.
And it seems like you kind of came around it from the other side. Like you, it seems almost more like a, well, it is more of a prayer of someone who's aware of what's going on with Screwtape than someone, you know, than like the demon writing the letter. What caused you to kind of take it from that different angle?
That was one of the things that was tricky, because what I didn't want to do is, while, like, because that book is tricky in that it's not totally fiction, but it's not completely nonfiction. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's just sort of in the middle. Like, it has a fictional base, but the fictional base is just the outline for him to say the nonfictional things that he wants to say. And so it's just a really kind of tricky situation to, you know, I think explain it the way that I wanted to. And so what I decided was, if I just took it from the point of view of, you know, the person that Wormwood and Screwtape, you know, are conspiring against, if I were able to make him aware of the situation,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, and so, you know, it starts off with some of the things that, you know, are being said, you know, in the letters, you know, between Wormwood and Screwtape, but it's essentially like the guy that's reading them, or it's me that's reading them, or you that's reading them. Any, you know, any person that is trying at night, you know, to say their prayers and, you know, just be a better person. Like, you know, they're basically recalling these things that they've read because they've essentially gotten a hold of the letters. And then, you know, the idea of, you know, the pre-chorus is, you know, something here wants to turn my hand. It's just the idea that you can feel it. You know, the Christian cliche of there's a battle going on and things like that, but, like, you can just feel something trying to tip the balance, not even for your heart, but for your attention. And, you know, that's one of the, you know, the biggest things that I took away from Screwtape Letters is that, you know, the power of evil doesn't want us to just, you know, deny all things Christian. You know, like, to just say, well, you know what, God, I don't like what you do, and so I choose something else. Like, it's better, because if you start thinking solely in terms of is God good or is God bad, what that could actually do is just draw you far closer to him. Because it makes you start asking some really serious questions.
Mm-hmm.
It could veer you the other direction, but it could very well just bring you closer. But what can't bring you closer to God is distracting you by what your grocery list is, mm-hmm. or, you know, what you need to DVR that night, or Dancing with the Stars, or
yeah.
soccer practice, or, you know, like, just the trivial things that aren't about evil or good. They're just about nothing. And
yeah.
like, those are the things that, you know, I think tip the balance. You know, I think that's one of the larger points that he was trying to get across. But, you know, that active feeling of I feel something trying to force my hand here, just that idea, of getting down to it and saying, like, you know what, I know what you're doing. I know you've been trying to distract me. I know that you've been trying to make me resent my mother while I'm trying to pray about people in Africa to feel better about myself, but I still have an issue with what my mom said to me earlier, something like that. And so then the chorus says, you know, as I lay me down to sleep, I pray my soul to keep, just that idea of, you know what, I've got a few hours where I can't put up a fight. You know, I got a few hours where I just have to rest and start again, and I'm just praying that you're going to, you know, you're going to take care of me while evil is conspiring against me. And so that when I wake up, you know, I can be ready to, you know, try and start this fight all over again. And then the bridge, you know, says, I read your letters. You know, just the idea of, like, I'm on to you. I know what you've been doing all this time. I became aware of it. And it was just, for me, it was an interesting perspective, you know, to try and, you know, almost as if C.S. Lewis had, you know, maybe after Wormwood proposes a toast, you know, from The World's Last Night, if he had, you know, maybe said, like, here's something extra. Here's, you know, the soul becomes aware of what's been going on. Maybe this is something that would happen.
Right.
So that's just the way that I approached it.
Yeah, I almost feel like we needed to label that with a spoiler, because it is like Screwtape Part 2. You know what happens next? And
yeah.
Absolutely.
Someone here wants to force my hand. Shade of comfort is the muted gray. It's the lukewarm water in between the hot and cold he spits out in disgrace.
On that album, you also covered a couple of fiction things. You got Edmund, obviously from the Narnia series, and Paralandra, and also Till We Have Faces. I guess The Great Divorce as well. What was your decision to choose certain fiction ones and then certain nonfiction ones? Was there a conscious decision there, or did it just happen?
Well, I knew I wanted to do 12 songs, and there were, you know, 7 or 8 books that really stood out to me, and I knew I wanted to do something from Narnia, the Narnia series, but I wanted it to be something that was not, you know, like, I think people could have easily, you know, if I had allowed myself, or, you know, if someone else had approached it, could have easily taken that decision of, like, we're just going to talk about how Aslan is Jesus, and, you know, just going to let it, that's what the song's going to be about. We're going to call it Aslan, and, you know, it's going to be, you know, 3.5 minutes of talking about how Jesus is Aslan. You know, I think in the whole, like, series, to me, the most interesting character is Edmund. I think he's the most fascinating. I think he's the one that you almost dislike him more than you dislike the White Witch, because you just know that she's inherently evil.
Right.
You don't understand why he's making the decisions that he's making, because he seems, you know, like he has glimpses of just being a good kid, and then he has glimpses of being selfish. And to me, that says Judas. You know, to me, that says Jacob and Esau. You know, to me, that, you know, that says King David. You know, to me, that's Solomon. You know, that just people who, it says almost everyone in the Old Testament, actually. but it just the idea of, you know, he loves his family. It's obvious that he has, you know, good intentions, but he's also swayed by porridge. He's swayed by, I think, you know, the Jacob and Esau story, I think, you know, there's two guilty parties in that, you know, is wanting to get the birthright blessings, and there's being such a pushover, you know, such a slave to your own, like, earthly wants,
mm-hmm.
that you would give away everything for, you know, freaking bowl of gumbo, you know, like that, that's where your, you know, where your mind is. And I just thought it was an interesting, you know, that he could play a lot of versatile characters if you were wanting to almost use it as symbolism or as allegory or whatever. And so, you know, I think as it moves on, it becomes a little more clear that the idea that I'm trying to sell is that, you know, he's got a lot of the Judas qualities, and that he sells his family down the river for, you know, Turkish delight, just like Judas sells his family down the river, or sells Jesus and his brothers essentially down the river for 30 silver pieces.
Yeah.
So that was a relatively easy leap for me to make. Like, I think I came to that one naturally.
My eyes are on you now. My appetite takes over when you lay me down. And I love my brother, but I'll sell him down. The river, the second that you lay me down.
Tara Landrum was tougher because with the Space Trilogy, you're dealing with a lot of stuff. And I was trying to keep in mind that not everyone that listens to this album is C.S. Lewis fan like I am. A lot of these people may have never read any of the books. And so I didn't want to make things so literal and so, you know, cause and effect related from the books that they wouldn't be able to understand, you know, what was going on in every song. And so from Paralandra, I just sort of wanted to take the idea of basically like heaven exists, or like Eden existing again, you know, like just that idea of, you know, a perfect place one more time.
Right.
But it's not heaven, it's just earth, and it's perfect. And, you know, sort of it's the second chance of, you know, just getting Eden again and seeing if we could get it right this time and not screw it up like we did before. And I think once I decided on that concept, the song wrote itself very quickly. But I knew I wanted to do something with the Space Trilogy, but I just wasn't sure exactly what the, you know, best approach would be. So it was tough to figure it out, but once I did, it wrote itself relatively quickly. And Until We Have Faces is one of my favorite C.S. Lewis books. So that actually wrote itself very quickly. I think it's just such a beautiful, beautiful story, and I've always been, you know, really into Greek mythology, and just, you know, it's one of his lesser known, lesser appreciated books, but yeah. I think it says a lot about, you know, the human condition and how it relates to, you know, how some people are drawn to worship and how the people who don't have that same influence are jealous, you know, jealous of the attention that you're giving to, you know, you're giving to God, or you're giving to, you know, sports, or your homework, or whatever, your family. You know, I think when my oldest brother got married, you know, I think I had that in me, you know, that like, this is going to change everything. You know, his wife is going to, you know, take him away. We're not going to be able to hang out anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, I quickly realized that it wasn't the case, that he was still my brother and he still wanted to hang out with me and needed me in his life as much as I did him. But there are other people, you know, that you can't figure that out. And, you know, they're jealous of those things. And I think that it's the same way with, you know, really making a firm decision to, you know, follow Christ and to try your best to adhere to the principles that, you know, he put out. That's a tough walk. It's a tough journey.
Yeah.
And it requires a lot of sacrifice on your own. And sometimes that means you need to leave some things behind. And in doing that, it might mean you need to leave some people behind. And that's a tough, you know, that's tough for people who are being left behind because they feel like you're making a decision based on where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
But really what you're doing is saying, look, I want to be with you, but I can't be a part of the things that you do. because they will bring me back to a place that I choose not to be.
Right.
So yeah, that was easier for me because I think I'm, you know, really respond to that book.
Deadlands and no escape. For shame still resides in that place. So die before you die, cause there's no chance after. And how will he see your face?
Let me ask you about some books you didn't choose, okay? I mean, why is English literature in the 16th century, excluding drama, not one of your songs?
Yeah, what's the deal, man?
I mean, come on, a 600-page book about English literature.
Oh, well, I mean, you guys wait 6 months. I'm doing a whole album on that. So.
You're here first.
It'll be listened to by 5 people. It'll be a huge hit. Yeah, that was that would never have even occurred to me.
I'd listen to it.
I did when I was in a band in college. I wanted to do a concept album that would have been just putting to music all of the poems and Spirits in Bondage, because it was public domain.
Okay.
And that was like, I mean, they're all written before he was a Christian, but there's like these echoes.
I'm working on a project right now. Just sort of chipping away at it as I go, as I'm inspired by it. Where each song is just going to be, you know, based on a short story that, you know, really affected me, whether as a kid or, you know, as a, you know, teenager or, you know, as a young adult as I am now. And, you know, there's going to be some Mark Twain, you know, there's going to be some Faulkner, some Hawthorne, you know, there's going to be, you know, some little short stories that I read as a kid. Little Match Girl might make its way into it. Like, you know, there's this, you know, and again, it won't be, you know, trying to, you know, retell the story. It'll just be the way that they hit me. And I think you can do that with anything. I think that's the great thing about music. Can be creative, but it can also be interpretive. And I do a lot of original creative stuff, but it's also really fun to sort of interpret things. And
yeah.
It makes the writing process actually quicker, more linear, and you can abstract things or you can really hone in on them depending on, you know, whatever you're feeling inspired to do. So, man, if you wanted to do that, you totally could do that. And if you wanted to do, you know, 1600 fingers English literature, there's probably a way you could make it happen.
Well, it reminds me of, like, you know, for instance, Iron Maiden did the Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. And it ended up being like this 13, 14-minute song because Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner is, you know, this massive, epic piece of work. And, you know, what are they going to cut out? So when you take something and you're just going to do it straight, you're either making vicious slashes to the whole thing or else you're just going to do it, you know, the way you did it on these songs.
Yeah, it, honestly, I love albums that can sort of tackle it in interesting ways. There's an MC, he's an amazing writer. There's Syntax the Terrific.
Yeah.
He has a blog that he does. It's amazing. And he's just a phenomenal hip-hop writer. And he had an album he put out last year called Prince with 1,000 Enemies, which the whole album is based on Watership Down.
Nice.
Really?
Yeah, and it's incredibly interesting just to see how he approached it. There are a lot of, you know, albums and songs that are influenced by things that you know, that we maybe wouldn't even know unless, like, the whole Nebraska album by Bruce Springsteen. He was watching Terrence Malick films at the time. That's why he did it. Like, that was his inspiration for that. And while you wouldn't know it by listening to it. Once you know that that's what he was inspired by, you can sort of say, this is a really depressing album. It's my favorite Springsteen album, actually. And I get it. I can understand now watching, you know, these broad sort of sweeping, you know, shots that, you know, Terrence Malick had decades ago, like how that could inspire, you know, an album like that.
Right.
Come to fruition. So, you know, it's, again, I feel like we're all influenced by something, whether we can put our finger on it or not. You know, sometimes a sunny day influences the song, sometimes being a, you know, family eating in a restaurant inspires a painting or whatever. And some of it is easier to put your hand around and say, this is my inspiration, or some of it is just a little more fleeting and abstract, but it's all the same thing.
Right. Now, what is it like being a recording artist in the 20-teens? I mean, with social media and, you know, having to market yourself. I mean, to walk us through that a little bit.
Oh, man. It's incredibly difficult. it's daunting. It's scary. It is lonely. It is. You know, but I can't say this, better than being on a label. I've been a part of both worlds, and I can at least say with, you know, living this life, I go down with my own decisions. Like, the mistakes I make and the proper decisions, you know, I am the one that reaps the benefit. It's like being a quarterback, you know. You're going to get all the glory for winning the game, whether you had that much to do with it or not. You're going to get all of the blame for losing it, whether you had that much to do with it or not.
Right.
So, you know, you're in charge of your, you know, of your little empire. And the issue is just the glut of information that there is out there. And for me, I'm just a little sensitive to that. I start feeling guilty for just being a part of it. Like, that's the hardest part of it all. Like, I remember it was right before Christmas, I was walking around Target, and there were just people everywhere. There's just music, and there's just shiny toys, and people buying candy, and, you know, just buying stuff, and just everything is going on at once. And I just felt really guilty and convicted that, like, I play a small part of this, like, that I am involved in the glut of media and information that exists. And it's just a weird time. It's a great time, but it's a weird time to be an artist, because you're just a very, very small hollow voice in the middle of just an ocean of other small hollow voices. And there are some that are bigger, and there are a couple that are huge. But even the ones that are huge, what is it ultimately leading to? What is it amounting to? Like, that, I think there should be some guilt and some humility attached to that. You know, even if you're doing the right thing, there still needs to be a little bit of shame attached to it, because, you know, sometimes I feel like, man, if I stop doing music, but in the process I can also make everybody else stop so that people could just focus on their families.
Right.
And their grades, and eating right, and exercising, and, you know, just being better people, would I do that? Or, you know, conversely, if I were able to make my music far more popular, but the end result is that people just become much more distracted, what am I willing to do? What matters to me? You know, being successful, even at the expense of everybody else's well-being, or, you know, sort of retreating, you know, into the shadows and sort of giving up, you know, what I feel called to do for the betterment of, you know, society. Like, those are tough questions. And because this is my full-time job, I have every second of the day to obsess over it. Like, some people don't. So, you know, you start putting yourself in some pretty, you know, precarious, you know, hypotheticals, and you start making things seem like they're a little more important and you know, dire than they actually are. At the end of the day, I'm just a dude who's doing an interview right now in my pajamas because I got in at 3 a.m. from a show, and, you know, I'm too tired to get moving yet. So, how much damage can I do for good or bad at the end of the day? You know, it's all about perspective, I suppose.
Cool.
The way I kind of look at it as a comic book writer and as a book writer is there's never been a better time to be doing that. There's never been a worse time to be doing that. It's just...
Yeah, I mean, you're right. The blessing is that everybody with a voice artistically can be heard. You know, the negative is that everybody with a voice can be heard. And, you know, there's some people that just don't need to be doing it. And that's just, that's true. Because you have GarageBand doesn't mean you need to make music. Because, you know, you have, you know, paint doesn't mean that you need to paint.
Yeah. And YouTube doesn't make you a director.
Yeah. But who am I? Who am I to fault people for, you know, trying to exercise, you know, their artistic muscle?
Yeah.
You know, it's just you're right. You're 100% right. It's the best and the worst time for this. But when you start thinking about what it was 200 years ago or what it could be 200 years from now, I start thinking, well, am I thinking about that for my own good? Oh, man, I probably would have been better off 200 years ago. Maybe I'll be better off a couple of centuries from now. Or am I thinking about that culturally? What's better? And again, like, I can't separate myself from it. I'm going to think selfishly because this is my job. So I'm always trying to, you know, figure out a way to make things more successful for myself. And there's a lot of complaining that goes on, you know, and you have to really, really... you know, convict yourself of that. And, you know, again, just show a lot of shame, a lot of humility for, you know, that even if your goals are 100% noble, there's still, like, some self-promotion that has to go on to make that happen. And that's just it's a really weird position for some people because I'm not 100% comfortable with being a self-promoter. Like, I'm a musician. I'm not a used car salesman. I don't, you know... I don't know how to do that and feel comfortable.
Right. What's it like nowadays? I mean, like when I used to do stuff and I never put out an album or anything like that. It was just, you know, stuff on the side. It was basically, you know, you're looking through, you know, stacks of wax, you're looking through cassette tapes and stuff like that and trying to find, you know, break beats and sounds and things that you can, you know, put together to make that song, to make it sort of your own. You know, how do you put together a song, or do you? Do you get your beat somewhere else, or what do you do with? How do you bridge that gap?
It's a grab bag, honestly. There's, you know, with the situation that I'm in now, there's no right answer to that. you know, I produce a lot of stuff on my own, but you know, I've got a little bit of a name, a little bit of a reputation, so a lot of times. Producers are sort of contacting me, wanting to work with me, sending me their, you know, their best work, you know, their best beat, their instrumentals, and stuff like that. So sometimes on the, you know, the hip hop side, sometimes it's stuff that I just sort of produce. And sometimes, you know, I have some very talented friends, you know, and peers. You know, my friend Plato,
mm-hmm.
Plato the Stone, Plato the Philosopher, you know, had a huge hand in, you know, getting me started a few years ago when I was in college and, you know, like, you know, he gave me, you know, the sort of first beat that I rapped over for the label when I didn't have the money to afford, you know, the gear or the means or the wherewithal to, you know, work on production on my own. What I tend to do is like to get skeletons from other guys, whether it's just really great drum breaks and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
so that my head is not completely on the musical side. And then I like to start laying down live elements myself. And then sometimes I'll just have a great sample in mind and, you know, we'll just sample it and, you know, throw drums on it and kind of move from there. There's no right way to do it anymore. I love sampling.
Chet Atkins stuff. Is that Grand Ole Opry rhyming auditorium stuff?
Yeah.
But I love live stuff too. I think what I love best is the marriage of the two.
Cool.
Like being able to have, you know, grimy, antiquated samples with, you know, gross dead space, and, you know, like being able to throw in little electric guitar, sort of flourishes here and there, and, you know, adding my own vocals to use as a sample, and, you know, just finding things that, that sound, old and current and sort of new and, a little bit ahead of the curve as well. You know, like, it's a really tough thing to do, to find something that just sounds familiar from the past, that sounds, like it's happening right now.
Right.
It's happening in the future. And usually what I end up doing is getting the first and the last of those. Like, I usually nail the, this is what it used to sound like, and I usually nail this is what it maybe will sound like later, but rarely do I nail that this is what it sounds like right now, sort of thing. And I think that's probably just a, probably the reason why radio or whatever, I don't know if I consciously avoid, sounding, like what is going on right this moment, but, it happens regardless, so.
Cool. My son is 11 years old, and he is just in love with Nintendo Thumb. Song from your first album, and you did the mixtape. KJ52 was on there and stuff. He had a question. He loves that song. My daughter, who's 9, she loves Smile on Me. Also from the first album. I haven't really turned him on much to your newer stuff, but I still had that one, and I'm looking for something to play in the car. And they just latched onto those two. My son asks, how do you remember the words of the songs in order? He's 11.
Honestly, that's from being in theater, and just having to remember a lot of lines and stuff like that. What ultimately happens is, being in college and learning all these lines, and you have to do it in such a short amount of time, you start to not remember the words, but the rhythm of the words. Mm-hmm. Like, you start to just remember, you're sort of going on autopilot, because if you're thinking about it, you're completely behind. Like, you're going to make a mistake. So it's just repetition to the point of, like, muscle memory, so you say them a million times, so that you can just say them in your sleep.
Right.
Like, it's like lifting weights or, running a marathon or shooting free throws or, like, just anything that's muscle memory related. I think lyrics and just memorization, there's a lot of that too. And a lot of that is boring sometimes. But for me, luckily, between writing, recording, mixing, engineering, mastering, and stuff like that, I've got the songs memorized, usually to the point of hating them before anybody's ever heard them. So.
The 8-bit masterpiece. When I was a little kid, I was bound to be a digital athlete. It came naturally, I didn't ask to be gifted. When I'm kicking it with Kid Icarus, I'm victorious, or I won't play it all. Won't take a loss, I won't push pause. I'll turn the game off. RBI or Tecmo Bowl or bases loaded, it's game over. Never gonna be intimidated. Innovative is my middle name. A legitimate claim, I'm bringing the pain. Call me Top Gun. I hunt ducks with a shotgun, not a pistol. You're pitiful. I'm RoboCop, that's literal. Girlies with
a gun. You've actually got to that point and said, you know what? This is going on my brand new album. I'm never gonna do it live because I hate it.
There are a lot of songs that I don't do live just because they wouldn't work in a live show setting.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think there's ever been a song that I'm like, I will not perform this. I can't stand how many times I've heard it. But there definitely are some songs that are trickier to mix. And by the time it's done, you're like, oh my gosh, if I never heard this song again, that would be, because you're hearing it hundreds and hundreds of times. And my favorite songs that I've ever heard in my life, I probably haven't listened to as much over the course of my lifetime as I've listened to, the songs on my album over the span of like 3 or 4 months.
Right.
So, you get tired of it really quick.
That's hilarious.
I'm curious what a show sounds like for you, just because of the vast range of different styles of music in your albums.
I'm curious as to what it sounds like too, because I've never made a set list.
Okay.
I just show up and play
Wow. And kind of what feels right. And that's just a lot of different audiences. Like, you know, you were talking about your son and daughter, you know, being attached to the first album. You know, it's a much more kid-friendly album.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that stuff I wrote when I was 16. 17, you know, so, you know, it's going to be, you know, a little more kid-friendly, you know.
Right.
I'm in my mid-20s now, you know, so where I'm going with music is going to be a little different. And, you know, so some things are, you know, sometimes I'm playing for junior hires. And that means all artistic credibility goes out the window, and you've got to be loud and obnoxious and you know, let them have a good time.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm playing at coffee shops, and they're not going to want to hear me rap, you know, about, you know, your mom calling me on the phone or something like that. You know, some very typical hip-hop, you know, goofy mixtape stuff. They're not going to hear that. They're going to hear, you know, a little more, you know, chill, mature stuff. So I've just learned, because my audience is as different as my taste is, that I can never go in with a set list and be like, this is going to be the set list for the night. They're going to love everything that I do. So I just, the one thing that I can say is I've just gotten very, very acute at feeling out the audience. Like, I've just gotten really, I think some people have that and some people don't. And I think that might be my best quality when it comes to live shows, is just being able to feel out the room. And, you know, I'm playing for people that usually don't know who I am. So it's not like U2 comes on stage and everybody's like, oh man, the minute when the Streets Have No Name starts, we're going to freak out. Like, that doesn't happen for me. You know, like, most people, even if they don't know me, a lot of people know the song Nintendo Thumb. That's about it. So, you know, I'm basically introducing myself every night.
Yeah, attention, ladies and gentlemen, guess who just entered in? Oh no, it's him again. He threw his Ritalin out the window, and there's not a penitentiary that can discipline him. Give him dirty looks, give him 30 right hooks, and if you think you hate him, now wait till you've heard the hook. He's obnoxious and he's obstinate. Let's hope we don't see him topless or cops again. His mom and pop said they think he lost it when the doctor lost his step and dropped him.
You can't go in with a script or a playbook. You know, you kind of just kind of got to feel it out. And so the live show looks different. The only thing that is very similar is that I do freestyle every night. But even, you know, in its nature, because it is a freestyle, nothing will be the same every night. It's just that I know that I will do it at some point every night. But that's pretty much it.
And is freestyling, are you just coming up with stuff like right off your head, or is this stuff you've, you know, kicked around before and it doesn't really have a form in a particular song yet?
No. For me specifically, it is like to freestyle in the moment and to let them know that that's happening. So I play games like, whatever they have in their pockets, whatever is not bolted down in the room, I just have them bring it up to the station and hold it up and I'll freestyle about it. There's a thing called a name game where, you know, hold the mic up, what's your name, and say their name, and I'll start freestyling about them. And do a game called Occupations, where it's have them call out a bunch of different jobs, and, you know, just sort of freestyle about those things. And, you know, just so that they know that it's happening in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I really pride myself on it being that way. I don't want to can something. And the thing is, because I freestyle every day, sometimes you're gonna repeat some stuff that you've said just because.
Right.
But it may not be the same way. But that's why when people hold up their phones, I'm like, no, I don't want my freestyles about your phone. You know, pull up a picture, pull up a funny text or something like that. You know, give me something. It's like Whose Line Is It Anyway, where, you know, a lot of the reason that it's improv is because you're taking suggestions from an audience.
Right.
You're able to. There are formats that work best, and, you know, you adhere to those, and so you save yourself a little bit of trouble in how to explain it. But, you know, it's very, very much improvisational in the moment.
Cool. Well, hey, we're hitting up to about an hour of recording time, so I think we're going to wrap it up. I know you got a live show to do, and we have lives as well. Is there anything else you would want to get out there? Last blast for our audience?
Websites, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, she...
Yeah, it's just, you know, where people can, you know, stay in touch with me and you know, feel free, you can follow me on Twitter, at TheHeathMcNasty is my Twitter handle, which is my old nickname from the little town I grew up in. You can follow me on Facebook at, you know, facebook.com/HeathMcNeese. All of my music is available for free on Bandcamp. This is Bandcamp. HeathMcNeese.bandcamp.com. I'm on Noise Train. They can also go to my website, HeathMcNeeseMusic.com, which just has a link for everything. My shows, all my music, all of my, you know, various forms of media and stuff like that. I'd love to, you know, stay in touch and, you know, come see a show when I'm in your area.
Very cool. All right, well, hey, Heath McNeese, thank you so much for coming on the show. All blessings to your stuff that you're getting out there and doing stuff, and you're in the real world. We're sort of like on the electronic part of it. You know, people hear us if they want to hear us, but you get out there and, you know, you're talking it live to real people. So God bless you in that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, guys. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much, man.
You've been listening to the Strangers and Aliens podcast, hosted by Ben Avery, Steve MacDonald, and Dr. Jace O'Neill. Our music was composed and mixed by Tim Leffel. Please join in the conversation by visiting our website, strangersandaliens.com, where you'll find show notes, articles, reviews, and more. You can also email us directly at podcast@strangersandaliens.com, or like us on Facebook at facebook.com/strangers, or you can leave us a voicemail on the Strangers and Aliens hotline. Just call 1-804-37-ALIEN and leave your message. And once again, thanks for listening. Brought to you by Audible.com, over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player, including many books by C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, Isaac Asimov, all your favorites. Get a free audiobook of your choice by going to audibletrial.com/strangers, where you can sign up for a free trial that you can cancel at any time, plus get a free audiobook that you get to keep as long as you want. Thank you for your support. Overweight and lifeless.